Welcome to a special edition of the Marketplace Roundtable podcast featuring Jay Mintzmyer of Value Investor's Edge. Jay first began contributing to Seeking Alpha in 2011, building up a large following through his work covering shipping stocks, probably about as comprehensively as they're covered anywhere online or in print. Since 2015, Jay has run the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. The service offers intensive coverage of deep value opportunities in the shipping, energy, MLP, and industrial sectors. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site. Before we begin, a brief disclaimer. Seeking Alpha is a website where authors from around the world share their ideas and analysis on the stock market. The Marketplace is our platform for authors to run investing analysis and idea services so that readers can take their investing to the next level. Nothing on this podcast should be taken as investment advice. And now your host, Jay Mintzmyer.
All right. Good morning, everyone. Good afternoon if you're dialing in from overseas. Welcome to the next iteration of our Value Investor's Edge Live. Today we are hosting Dorian LPG. We'll be hosting the CFO, Ted Young, and CEO of Dorian USA LPG, John Lycouris, basically their chief operating officer, here today to talk about the VLGC markets, as well as Dorian LPG in particular, what their capital allocation plans are, what their strategy is in this market, what their leverage targets are, growth projections, and such. So we're looking forward to this conversation, especially after really just 4 to 5 months of incredible recovery in VLGC rates after a sort of a brief hiatus in June and July. As a reminder, nothing you hear today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations on my behalf or the company's behalf in any format. I currently have a long position in Dorian. This recording is being done on 5 November 2020 at about 10 a.m. Eastern Time. Keep that in mind if you're listening to a recording at a later date. With that said, Ted, welcome today. Really appreciate you joining us.
Thanks, Jay. Appreciate your setting this up, and great to see so many investors or potential investors on the line. Just to dispense with formalities, Jay covered most of it, but just as a reminder, there will be no guidance here. We obviously will make certain forward-looking statements that, you know, can be identified by terms such as anticipate, believe, could, estimate, expect, intend, may, plan, predict, project, and similar terms and phrases. And obviously, these forward-looking statements are based on assumptions, based on best information and belief at the time. However, actual results could differ materially. Remind you that all the risk factors for our company are outlined in glorious detail in both our 10K and 10Q. So with that behind us, Jay, I'll turn it back to you to open up.
Excellent. Thanks, Ted. Yeah, I noticed you got the lawyers helping you out on that one. It's always good to get those out of the way. So yeah, just let me know when John gets on as well, because I'm sure he'll have some great insights for us in terms of the actual markets and stuff he's seeing on the ground, so to speak. Yep. But first question, and I think we'll reattack this well with John later as well, but look, these VLGC rates have been surprisingly strong. I mean, I've been bullish on the market as an analyst and as an investor, but I've been surprised by the resiliency of the rates. We saw with COVID-19 happen, we saw a dip down to about 20,000 in June and July, and a lot of the consensus, or at least the feeling in the market, was that kind of that long run in 2019 was kind of coming to a close, right? And then kind of surprise, surprise, in July and August, we got all that strength back. And it hasn't dropped off at all. And the arbitrage is still wide open. So I guess, what are you seeing, and what is holding this market up? Like, what are some of the drivers in the current term?
I'll jump on it, and then John Lycouris just joined in. So I'd say, you know, we share your pleasure at the strength of the markets. I think, you know, this is obviously such a unique time in the cycle and in the world. But fundamentally, the strength of rates speaks to me fundamentally about the versatility and the widespread usage of propane and butane, of LPG. So clearly, we've seen, you know, almost record-breaking imports into India. No surprise, people are at home. India uses 80%+ of its imports for cooking, and to a lesser extent, heating. So, you know, the fact that people are in lockdown, you know, obviously helps the business. We've seen recovering demand out of China. And again, that's not surprising given the worldwide demand for personal protective equipment. We're seeing solid plastics demand in spite of the naphtha LPG are not really totally being in our favor, but the PDH plants, the propane dehydrogenation plants that are the direct on purpose way of making propane, are an increasingly important part of the global propylene mix. And because there's no bid away from naphtha, it sort of supported LPG demand pretty well. So, I think basically the fundamentals, obviously we've benefited from a relatively balanced fleet size. The number of dry dockings this year hasn't hurt anything. And we're going to see more of that next year. So, I think it's the fundamentals. John Lycouris, if you're ready to add anything else on the current market conditions, I think people would welcome that.
Oh, sure, Ted. Thank you very much. Hello, everybody. Regarding propane and butane, the market has continued strong. Really, I have to take you back to 2012-13 when we first saw the opportunity and decided to expand our fleet. We saw that the United States was going to become an exporter. It was 2012 when, the first installation export terminal happened then, and people did not expect it, did not believe. And we've had surprising export capacity every year since then. And it continues. At some point, we thought there's going to be not enough export capacity for the product. However, the product continues to come out. And we see that the terminals, and now there's so many terminals that are adding new capacity, adding new fractionation, adding new storage and chilling facilities. So we understand that people are skeptical about this, but we believe and we can see it because we are there at those terminals all the time. And we do talk with the exporters. They are putting more capacity because they need to, because the United States is plateau at its requirements. And there is significant amounts of NGLs that come out of all the wells, whether they are producing for gas or they're producing for crude oil. We still see a lot of NGLs, and NGLs is the monetization of the stream of gas production and crude oil production. It's a very good monetization, and the fractionation of the product into all these components is very important for them because it sells well and it makes money along the way.
The U.S. push and the India pull has been just fascinating to watch over the last 5 years. And just when it seemed like, the exports might slow or India might slow down, of course, we had the COVID lockdowns. And if anything, that accelerated their demand. So that was very interesting to watch.
As you might have heard, Jay, during our earnings, we wanted to say also, I don't know if it was mentioned enough, but India has this program of giving power, butane and gas, propane gas and butane to so many millions of homes. And they have done a fantastic job in doing that. And, they're giving it now to people below the poverty line and for free. And they're extending those programs. And, the lockdown in their part of the world cost them a lot because their indigenous capacity, their own refineries that were producing some NGLs from the refining of crude oil or natural gas, they were producing some NGLs. And those NGLs were going all to the local domestic market. However, now they have lockdowns and slowdowns and they don't have enough gas to provide the whole country. So we've seen a huge increase in India this year from requiring more gas, more than we have ever expected. And that's why India is going to be probably 20% up this year, which is a significant amount of gas that needs to go there. Once the numbers are all settled, I think it will be very near 20% increase year on year.
Yeah, that's remarkable, especially for a country that had been already growing at a breakneck pace for many years. So we've hit, I think, the bullish notes very well. And I mean, it's always good to hit them again, because I think the broad market doesn't quite understand the differentiation, right, of LPG transport versus, say, LNG or crude oil, right? I don't think the broad market quite understands that. So it's always good to hit that. But I think broadly, most of the investors on the call, at least today, maybe not if we post the recording later, but I think today are quite familiar with the bullish story. Probably shared it a lot on my behalf. But let's talk a little bit. Let's pivot a little bit and talk about some of the risks. So some of the potential challenges around the corner. Because I know one of them that I've heard is that the Panama Canal has a lot of congestion and the rates are kind of artificially being boosted because of that. That's one thing I've heard. And the other thing that I think a lot of European analysts have picked up on. And it's always interesting to hear, you know, the commentary about the U.S. oil markets from, you know, Norway. But one of the, you know, concerns that I've heard is that, of course, the low oil prices will reduce U.S. hydrocarbon production across the spectrum, and that will lead to a reduction in U.S. exports, which, of course, as you pointed out, has been a great driver for the market. So let's talk about the Panama Canal and U.S. oil production, and also potentially any other sort of risk that you or Ted are looking at.
Well, you know, this year has been an exceptional year, a very difficult year for everybody. And as John Hizipatera has mentioned, our chairman and CEO, crew has been our uppermost concern. And trying to rotate and get crews out of the ships and onto ships has been a logistical nightmare. It's been a very difficult job. And we have been trying very hard to achieve those changes of crew that needs to go home, crew that needs to come on board. So that has been very important. And I'm sorry to not to address your two points right away. I just wanted to make sure that everybody understands that. It's an exceptionally difficult time for all of us. So that's getting that out of the way. The questions that you mentioned, it's NGLs from crude oil. Yes, I understand that it is potentially an issue. However, we have seen that the Permian has been, to use a phrase that I don't like, it's been a game changer because it's so rich in NGLs. For every barrel that comes out, almost 50% is NGLs. So whether you like it or not, you know, you're going to get a lot of NGLs out of the Permian fields, which have, you know, flooded the markets. And propane and butane has to price to go. So it will price at the right price. Even if crude oil keeps coming down, maybe the R with naphtha might become a little bit negative, or I mean positive. That is, the naphtha might be a little bit cheaper than propane at some points. So it will make certain petrochemical areas of the world to choose naphtha instead of propane. However, we need propane for domestic use. We need propane for PDH plants. We need propane for so many other uses that propane will move and will price at whatever price it is. Now, it has been quite expensive versus crude oil. And the reason has been because there's been a huge demand for propane. There has been a good demand over in the Far East for propane, and there has been a good demand in India, so that has kept the price of the product well bid. We have seen propane and butane go lower in price, and we saw it actually earlier. We had seen propane go down to 20% or 25% of a barrel of WTI in price, a barrel per gallon. Usually we talk about cents per gallon. So it prices correctly and very quickly it fixes any aberration. The Panama Canal has been affected by COVID. And because the new Panama Canal requires tugs to move the ships through the locks, and then they have to steam across the various lakes and then back into the locks again on the other side. Those crews of the tugs had problems. They had been infected by COVID. They had, to slow down, and they had lost a lot of these people due to the sickness, due to the disease, and they did not have trained masters and trained people to deal with. So this is what caused a bit of a slowdown in Panama. And now we have a kind of a waiting queue of ships on both sides, a few more on the northbound than the southbound. But I think they will work it out because they are managing now. They are starting to put through. We had seen it go down to about 8 ships a day, 4 ships this way, or 5 and 3, or I'm talking about northbound and southbound, 5 and 3, 5 and 4, and so on. Now I've seen that they are starting to go towards 10 and 11 and 12, which was their record before they were, their aim was to get to 15 a day. I haven't seen that yet, but I think they're working towards that, and they will work down that waiting queue of ships. Will it affect the market? Well, it always kind of makes stems to be delayed, to be picked up, maybe tightens the market a little bit for shipping. Yeah, perhaps it does. So it will soften it up. It should, and I'm not saying that it shouldn't, but we'll see. We'll see how things go. For the time being, though, there is a queue, and we are looking at booking slots for ourselves very far forward. I mean, sometimes we go into 1 year ahead, as it is permitted by the Panama Canal to book slots, and we book slots regularly for every month for the next 12 months. So it gives us the ability to logistically transit our vessels with reserved slots.
Jay, yeah, just also go ahead, maybe just to add a little bit on that, a couple of those points. John sort of touched on it, but we are seeing an increasing proportion of NGLs coming out of the ground in what they're drilling now. Unfortunately, the cash costs, the cash break-even costs continue to decline in a lot of these places just because of technological improvements. And the other, so I think even if there's less drilling, we're probably getting more NGLs per barrel, or we appear to be. So that's a bit of a significant mitigant, not to mention the fact that we still have pretty high inventories on a 5-year average basis. So, there's still inventories to draw on to support shipping before we actually have to worry about the totally direct correlation between production and shipping capacity utilization. And again, hard to quantify the effect of the delays at the Panama Canal, but it's not the first time we've had delays in the Panama Canal. It won't be the last time. I mean, there's always, something going on, as you expect to see, hopefully over time, an improving economic climate, hopefully we're going to see more activity in the Panama Canal, which generally drives, can lead to some delays. I mean, right now, yes, there's COVID-related delays, but look, we've literally zero cruise ships going through the canal, right? There's no cruise ships. They're usually, a couple of transits a day. I don't know what military activity is doing right now, but that they're usually in there. Container ship activity is a bit more muted. So the overall economic environment's contributed somewhat less activity. So if as and when we see the rebound, I think that we all as investors hope for and expect, I think you're naturally going to see some of those delays that were potentially a bit unique or peculiar to COVID. Be replaced by more traditional traffic at the canal.
Yeah, thanks, Ted, and thanks, John. Yeah, I think historically there's been a correlation. I'm going, you know, historically back even to like the 1990s, there's been a correlation between crude oil pricing and LPG production and exports and whatnot. But of course, that was in the 90s, right? And early 2000s, that was before fracking. That was before the shift to kind of a wetter mix of gas, of course. So I think maybe some of the EIA models and some of the analyst models are maybe based on a historical correlation. At least it seems that way, right? It seems like a lot of these models, you plug in a lower oil price, and you know, common sense would dictate lower oil price, lower oil production, and then you kind of look at this historical correlation in the United States, and you say, well, does that mean LPG comes down? And of course, I think you and I have talked before. You look at all the fractionation capacity coming online, and you look at all the new export capacity coming online, and it's just a totally different, more complex mix than that. Panama Canal is very interesting because it affects not only LPG. Of course, it's, as you mentioned, it's affecting containers, and you know, investors have been burned, I think, with kind of an over-optimism, and I'm guilty of this myself, in the crude tanker space. And I think there's kind of a natural skepticism that comes along to any space that's doing well, right? It's like, it almost like defies common sense that shipping should be doing well during a global pandemic, right? And it's kind of like, you know, what's the gotcha, right? And like, what's going on and what's going to correct? So let's look at what happened. I think one more question on risk, because I think this is really the most important thing to talk about here, especially with where your stock's trading. So June and July, those rates were bad. Not terrible, right? It wasn't cash burn season, but you know, $20,000 a day was the rough rate. What led to that sudden drop off? And is there any sort of potential that you see in the near term for any sort of return to that sort of 20,000, 25,000 type rate?
So I think, you know, part of it was, you know, the June, July, you know, realizations were, you know, we were still going on steam. We were still going on, you know, momentum steam, whatever you want to call it, from the very strong winter market. I think there was, you know, one of the big things was there was a big run up in advance of the Indian shutdown, because India literally took no cargoes for a month or 6 weeks. So some of that was just catch up. All of a sudden, there was just more capacity, less demand. You know, and I think, you know, product pricing wasn't helping in that environment. You know, relative product pricing wasn't really working in our favor. So that sort of dampened demand. And I also think there was general concern about the global economic environment. And so I think you saw, you know, cargo lifters sort of taking their time, rethinking things. And you know, now that you know, we had a good fall, you know, there was obviously a lot more activity. You know, is there a risk with the second wave of lockdowns that we see a wavering of confidence and we see concerns about the future? Yeah, absolutely. I'm not going to tell you there isn't, but on the other hand, you know, we also have higher inventories. You know we're going to see drawdowns going through the winter season. Historically, Jay, as you know, the winter market that we're in right now has historically been a bit seasonally weaker. So it will probably be hard to differentiate, in my mind, sort of winter weakness, if there is some, versus any COVID-related effects. But I wouldn't say that, at least personally, I see a near-term imminent risk of return to those rates. The FFAs and for LPG, which are, you know, admittedly rather imperfect and truly hedging tools as opposed to forward speculation tools, you know, would suggest a fairly, you know, fairly good market next year. And again, you know, we have all sorts of complexity between interplay between, you know, LPG prices around the world, oil and natural gas prices in a couple key places, ship supply, and obviously we have a number of new buildings coming on next year, but we also have the entire class of 2016, which is 41 ships, that's in principle due for its five-year special survey. And obviously we've got the 2011 ships and the 2006 ships. So there's going to be plenty of dry docking activity next year. So to the extent that there is a fundamental risk, which I won't exclude, although I don't place a high likelihood on, I also feel like there's enough mitigants out there that should give us some comfort on the downside.
Yeah, thanks for that, Ted. It's interesting to see, you know, the just overall market balance and sort of viewpoints have definitely improved. I know back in April and May, when we talked and other folks talked, of course, it was a much more uncertain market. And I think things have came through really well. So let's kind of shift gears a little bit and talk about capital allocation and strategy for the company. You know, we're in a position here where we have outstanding liquidity. And we'll dive into that real quick on the cash balances and whatnot. We have a very clean balance sheet, 30% or so net debt to assets, no substantial maturities anytime soon. You're buying back your higher cost leases. Everything's looking good. And the market's looking great. The supply balance is not concerning, really. There's, as you mentioned, survey off-hire coming. There's retrofit off-hire coming from one of your peers in the market. And yet we have this stock, which trades at, frankly, the lowest valuation I've ever seen a shipping stock trade in terms of enterprise value to gross asset value. In terms of price to NAV, you know, it's trading at basically, it depends on what broker valuation you use, of course, but somewhere between 50 and 60% discount to NAV. It's trading at a 45% discount to gross asset value, which is phenomenal. It's rare to see a company trade below a 10% or 15% discount in that category. So there's clearly some sort of weird disconnect. So let's talk about that a little bit. What do you think is driving that disconnect, and what sort of strategies, what can Dorian do to really, you know, fix that disconnect or profit from it and benefit from it?
So I'd say that, look, what the market's implicitly saying, at least from our perspective, you know, and just using, you know, the most basic corporate finance principles is, you know, they're obviously forecasting, either that we're going to make catastrophic decisions with our cash, or that, or the industry's in for another downturn. And so they're pricing that in, with a much lower discount rate than probably is justified. You know, look, if you look back to 2016, when we entered, you know, the 3-year nuclear winter of 2016 to 2018, the market, you know, was somewhat prescient. I'll have to admit at that point in terms of what we were looking at. However, we also had an astronomical order book driven by the growth in the U.S. So we're looking at a very different set of circumstances today. I think we're victims of the larger energy sell-off for sure. How we fix it, that's a great question. I think, you know, part of it has to be in capital allocation. So, you know, I guess part of it is how do we capture that value disconnect? You know, that sort of leaves us with three levers to pull, buybacks, dividends, and debt repayment. I suppose four just toward cash. You know, we have not paid a dividend yet because, you know, the stock has frankly been at such tremendous discounts that it's sort of difficult to justify. However, there's certainly a philosophical debate to be had about whether a dividend would be a better use of or more desired by investors because it truly gives you a choice. A stock buyback only gives an investor a choice between increasing his exposure or reducing his exposure. A dividend allows him to increase his exposure by buying back shares, reinvesting the funds, or, you know, taking his wife to Vegas. So from our perspective, it's still a discussion to be had. Our board discusses that regularly, but right now, you know, Jay, you kind of commented on the cheapness, and the cheapness is great as long as there's not a good reason for it. And you've given us, I'll say, some candid and unvarnished feedback about your beliefs about the pace with which we should be buying back stock. And, you know, we take that on board as we take on all investor feedback. But there's a balance to be struck between capturing that discount, not excessively decreasing the float of an already investable, you know, a stock that's at a challenging levels of investability given its float, as well as not squandering a cash pile that we spent a lot of time and effort to build, in a balance sheet that we spent a lot of time and effort to build up to I think, as you said, a very good place. So I think what you'll see is, I'm not sure how we fix it. other than, you know, continued investor outreach. But we will try to continue to maintain a focus on share repurchases. Our CEO was as crystal clear as he's ever been on that topic on our earnings call on Monday. And I think that's where you'll see the near-term focus for our company, with looking to redeploy some of that cash in a shareholder-friendly manner.
Yeah, Ted, I appreciate you hitting all the bases there. I know you got to cover everything. I'll be honest, the chat board is not super pleased with all the circular talk on that. I think a lot of folks just want to see action now. But I do understand you have to consider all things, and you have to, you know, be political and not commit to something right off the bat. It was interesting, as you mentioned, your CEO, basically, I mean, Omar Nokta asked him right on the call from Clarkson's about the repurchase, and it was about as flat of a positive answer as you could get. Hopefully, we'll see that follow through. I think last year we talked, Ted, and similar market. We didn't have COVID, right, but a similar rate environment, and Dorian was in good financial shape, but not great, right? Maybe you say like you were like a balance sheet was maybe like a B or B minus. And of course now it's an A plus, right? And I asked you about how much restricted cash you needed, or how much total cash balances you needed, and what made you feel comfortable. And I think, correct me if I'm wrong, but the conversation was basically, well, we'd like to have at least 50 million of excess cash. 100 million would be really nice, would make us feel really comfortable. So now we're at a balance where it of course includes, if you include the pool capital, that changes things, right? If you include the pool capital, you're pushing by the end of the year 200 million, right? If you don't include the pool capital, I don't know. I think you said, I want to say you said 145 million on the end of the call a couple of days ago. So what?
No, we're at $135, $136 on October 30th.
Yeah, I know you can't give, you know, direct guidance, but I thought you said that on the call, so it's public information. So yeah, 136 million. So how does that compare to like our chat we had last year when it was, you know, 50 to 100, even 100 was kind of like, that would be really luxury, you know, to have that.
Well, now I think 50 was an absolute bare minimum in a downside market. In other words, if we got down to that level, we'd start getting worried. You know, look, some simple math would suggest that somewhere in the $80 to $100 million range would be nice, because, you know, look, if we saw rates, you know, sort of decline to a point where we were making, say, $15,000 a calendar day, which is probably 17, 18 an available day, you know, that would cost us about $40 million. You know, and while I would like to have 3 years, because we went through a 3-year down cycle, that's probably a bit too conservative for everybody else's taste. So unfortunately, I'm not the sole arbiter of that, but that would suggest that 80 million is a minimum good number. Look, you'd like to have some cash to pounce on buying opportunities. So, you know, that puts you at sort of, you know, maybe 100. You know, so say I want 80 and another 20, 25. So, you know, and again, we haven't been, you know, so dogmatic in guiding on this, so that we have made public comments to this effect. You know, the other thing is our dry docking bill, excluding any capital upgrades, runs about $5 million every 5 years $5 million a year, because, you know, we've got 22 ships and it's, you know, we have, you know, 19 that come due pretty much the same time. So, you know, you've got to sort of budget for that as well. So, you know, the point being that where we sit today with, you know, just as a reminder, the figures, Jay, you touched on a couple of them, just to put the dates and the numbers together for everybody's benefit. We ended the quarter with $145 million in cash. We repurchased one of the vessels that we had in a Japanese sale leaseback for $18 million. So that brought us down to $127 million. And then we got, you know, just some other cash flow. And so when we announced on Monday, we reported a cash balance of $135 million, $136 million. So we went from $145 million down to $127 million, back up to $135 million, $136 million. So, you know, so again, you know, we're at those levels, there is some excess cash by the math I just walked you guys through. Maybe not as much as everyone would say, but you know, there is clearly some excess cash. And I think again, you know, look, we saw a pretty ugly downturn, and we have not gone back to shareholders and asked for money. Equity is expensive. I think everybody on this call would readily agree with that. And, you know, we're trying to avoid that. And, you know, if we're too conservative on that basis, well, I'll accept that sin. I'll accept that moniker. You know, I don't think we've missed tons of buying opportunities. Stocks still beat up. I think we feel better about our forward visibility or near-term forward visibility. So again, you know, we wouldn't have said what we said on the earnings call on Monday if we didn't intend to act on it. That would be, well, it'd be illegal first and foremost, but it would be rather silly and if nothing else. So, you know, I hope that everybody will, you know, think that, you know, when they see results that we were putting our money where our mouth is and capturing buying opportunities as we see them. You know, one of the problems, of course, is in terms of the buybacks is, you know, there's not a ton of volume in our stock and the 10b-18 numbers are small. I mean, currently, I mean, you guys can look it up on Bloomberg, right? You get a LPG equity AQR and it's like we can only purchase less than 90,000 shares a day. So it's a slow drip feed to make a meaningful dent. But, you know, we're doing our best in terms of delivering on what we said to investors, and we'll continue to be mindful of that.
Right. I appreciate you hitting that, Ted. And you know, I will throw one olive branch to you, at least. I know Dorian is probably the only shipping stock, or at least one of the only stocks, where you can look at the share count 5 years ago and you consider you had a three-year downturn, and you're the only shipping stock that has a reduction, a fairly meaningful, you know, 10 to 15% reduction in share count. So that is worth remembering, right? And not to lose sight of that.
Thank you, Jay. That's a very good point. Yeah,
so I'll be fair to you there.
$80 in stocks since our IPO.
Exactly. And I'll be fair to you there. And I've seen you do repurchases a few years ago, and you did a lot of repurchases last year, right? At $11 a share. And I think pundits would say, would argue that was a mistake, right? Because now the stock's $8. But, you know, I don't see it that way as an investor, because you were investing in a fleet that was worth $18 or $16 a share, and you're buying it for $11. So at this point, you have a fleet that it depends on the broker, it depends on your forward expectations, but is worth somewhere between, at the absolute low end, $16 a share. At the highest end, which I think I'm probably one of the higher ones in the market, I have you at $21 a share. So, you know, 16 to 21. And your stock's like $8.30 today, $8.20 today. So, you know, you talk about growing the fleet or growth opportunities, right? And it's just, there's this amazing growth opportunity in terms of like your own fleet, you know, and it's a great fleet. So I think that is kind of just the frustrating thing that a lot of investors have, you know, and they're saying like, why not do a tender offer, or why not ramp up? And I understand you have limitations on the, you know, SEC policies, but, you know, a tender offer at $9 or $9.50 would send such a powerful signal. So I think that's kind of, you know, if you're just packaging all like what these investors are looking at, they're really wanting the company to send a vote of confidence. You know, they really say, look, we believe in our fleet. We think the market's wrong. We think a 40% discount to NAV is like ridiculous. But I also understand the 100 million, you know, cash balance. But look, you said 135. So there's 35 million bucks in there, Ted, to play with. So one more question, one quick follow up. I'm looking at your 10Q, and I just want to make sure that, you know, I'm not reading this filing incorrectly or whatnot. You have $55 million due from related parties as of September 30th. My understanding is that almost all of that is pool cash.
Yep. And it's not pool cash, Jay. It's pool profit receivables. It's not cash.
Okay. So it's receivables that you expect to generate within the coming, would that be the next few quarters, or what's the timing on that?
Yes. Well, that's why it's short term. That's why it's booked as a short term asset.
Right. Technically less than 12 months. But what is sort of, I guess, the generation of that? When will that 55 million, because eventually that 55 million will turn into cash. So what is
It will. It generally turns into cash over a 2 to 4 month period.
Okay, that's good to know, because I think, you know, investors can look at that and say, you know, maybe not a 1-to-1 ratio, but they can look at that and they say, you know, my God, we got 140, you said 135 pro forma for the lease. We got 55 million sitting there that, you know, we're pushing, you know, $4 a share in cash and, you know, pro forma for the end of the year. And your stock's at $8. You know, it's just remarkable.
No, I mean, we've got like, you know, $3 a share in cash, you know, give or take. And, you know, so, I mean, look, we don't comment for obvious reasons on the valuation of our stock, but, you make a lot of, very relevant points. And again, I just throw in there, you know, $3 a share in cash. So yes, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of opportunity there, I guess.
Yeah, and I think most of the folks on the call today understand that. I think it's more when you talk to the broader market. I told a person the other day, an investor, a small hedge fund, about your company, and he had a hard time believing me when I was like, look, it's an $8 stock with $4 in cash with 30% debt with the rates through the roof. It's hard for folks to believe that. Especially in the energy space. So look, we've beaten some dead horses, but this is a topic that's important to investors. Let's talk dividends. Is there any, I know you can't give official guidance, of course, and that would be out of turn, right? Your CEO is not here, but is there any consideration of a dividend? Because I think that would be interesting to a lot of folks.
Yeah, look, as I said before, there's always consideration of a dividend. And I don't mean to, inflame the chat boards, but it's always a discussion, and it has been because look, there's an amount of cash that's available for return to shareholders, however that may be. There's a healthy debate around buying back what is probably an undervalued stock versus paying it out as a dividend to shareholders. There's tax considerations. There's just the fundamental corporate finance question of paying a dividend when your stock is cheap. Isn't that terrible signaling? But all that said, my point is that there's a very robust debate at the board level as recently as last week about dividend buyback. What are we going to do here? So I can't give you I won't give you the positive comfort to say, oh yeah, it's absolutely on the table, because that would be more forthcoming than I think it's appropriate for a public company to be. But I would absolutely confirm that it is not at all off the table, and it is very much part of the conversation.
Ted, I think it's what folks want to hear, at least that it's in consideration. I know a shipping company with a high spot exposure is not necessarily designed for a fixed dividend, right? It's just, in some form, you're just returning cash. But look, I mean, if we get to the point where there's $250 million of cash sitting there, and you decide that, look, for whatever reason, and that could happen, right? I mean, that could happen realistically.
Yeah.
If you don't repurchase enough, Ted, that could happen.
That's what I was going to say. I mean, that means we didn't repurchase anything, and we couldn't find anything to invest in. So yeah, I mean, I won't even say that's a high class problem. That would probably be a bit of a misallocation. I don't want to watch it happen and then I'll say it. So I would hope that we would be more foresightful than to allow a huge amount of cash to burn a hole in our pocket. Unless, of course, we see the world coming to a screeching halt, in which case, we'd say, guys, we need this money to withstand, what's coming.
Well, if you feel the urge to spend a lot of that money, always consider the idea of like $100 million, $2 per share special dividend. That will help relieve that desire to blow money in weird places.
Yeah, I mean, look, so far we haven't blown money. We don't intend to start. But your point, you're right. I mean, look, and in particular, Jay, I guess Jay, just because you raised it and it's valuable in the context of this discussion, I think you're right that shipping companies with heavy spot exposure are not designed to be regular dividend payers. That said, when we've talked about dividends, it's much more along the lines of a special dividend to, basically return accumulated profits. It's not going to be, we're not set up to be yield play. Suppose that's one of the problems is we'll pay a dividend, it'll go into our total return, but investors really never give us any long-term credit for it. It is the owner's cash, right? And that's the investor. So we do get that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah. If it gets to a point where there's nothing to do and the repurchases aren't going fast enough, I think a $1 to $2 special dividend would really, really help for investors. You have two captain leases coming up, I think next summer. I know you can't give official formal guidance, but if you were to repurchase those, what's kind of the cash outlay expected next summer on those?
About $17 million outstanding on one and, $15 million on the other, let's say, something in that zip code. So, but there's it's going to depend on the owners in those cases took out swaps, and there's a mark to market kind of true up on the swap. So, We have to see where that would come out, but it would be, you know, I don't know. It would be probably in the range of $17-18 million per ship in total.
Yeah, so not significant, but maybe 33-34 million, something like that. So correct. if you did that, you would have three ships that are not, they're not old ships, but they're not eco. Also, they're kind of, you know, in the middle there.
Yeah, they're old. Yep.
Three ships that are debt free. Are those ships considered still core, or would those be more so maybe held for sale at that point?
I mean, look, this is shipping. I mean, we just own assets. You know, everything's for sale at the right price. I mean, if somebody comes up and offers us the right price for one of our 2015 builds, we're going to look really hard at it. I guess I'd look at it differently. Are we looking to get rid of those assets at any price? Absolutely not. They still earn great. You know, the costs, the operating costs are virtually identical. So, but if, you know, if somebody decides that they want to bid us for those assets, you know, we'll certainly look at them.
There's a twist on these ships. They are the last ships that were built with ammonia features, so they can carry ammonia. And that's an important future possibility, that ammonia becomes more extensively used in shipping, maybe in 24, 25. Maybe those ships will have a good use being ammonia carriers, and that can handle ammonia as their cargo.
Definitely interesting to hear about. I actually didn't know that, John, so thanks for adding that. LPG retrofits, where are we at on that? Is that a serious conversation yet, or is that still, you know, a couple of years in the future kind of thing?
That's John LaCourse will jump in and take that. And by the way, John, go ahead. Sorry.
Retrofits, we will consider them. We were the first ones who thought about it back in 2012-13, we wanted our ships to have LPG as fuel. We did fit them with certain features. We did think of that, and we do still want to review that. However, there are no LPG as fuel engines yet ready, except one ship which was just retrofitted and is just finished her trials. That's the first ship with a retrofitted LPG as fuel engine. We are still waiting for the new building ships to come out in 2021. So we have a number of ships that will come out as new buildings in 2021, and we will see how the retrofits of are happening in China with this other company. So we'd like to see and benefit from that learning lesson of the stakeholders in that, and see how it comes out on the other side with performance, the costs, which is a very important one, and which is something that really set us behind, because it was a significant amount of cost to do these retrofits. And as maybe you've heard in the public domain, we mentioned that these costs are about three times a scrubber retrofit. So this is a significant amount of CapEx.
Yeah, it's a significant amount of cash that would be required, and it's sort of unproven, as you mentioned. And, you know, let's let someone else spend the big bucks and see how they do first, right? I think that's what you've kind of communicated and suggested in the past, and I hope that's still the plan. I think investors see $200 million pro forma building up on your sheets, and they get concerned that, you know, money burns a hole in your pocket, right? And let's not get too crazy when the stock's at 40% NAV, right? So that's, I guess, kind of, that's me kind of saying what I'm feeling, but.
But there's also the economic reason. With crude oil so low, the bunker fuel of the ships is very cheap as well. As a result, it is almost cheaper than buying LPG, to fuel your ship, to run it. So even the economics of that is not, this year hasn't worked out. Before that, in 2019, it looked like a foregone conclusion. We should do this. And that's when BW did the decision. They made the decision in 2018 and 19. And we were discussing it with them because we thought it was a great deal. But as it happens, as luck has it, we had this pandemic, we had the meltdown of crude oil, the meltdown of production, and all that has really stopped, arrested everything, which is what the point that I wanted to make to your earlier comment, what happened in April and May. Well, what happened is everybody stopped. Everybody stopped. Production stopped. Everything stopped. So we saw the result of that stoppage in June and July. It's like the carryover from that shock that everybody got. And still, crude oil has not recovered well from that. And we're still waiting to see what's going to happen. So sorry, I just took a little bit too much time on this.
It's good to cover the economic basis for it in the decision-making process. I think investors are very happy to hear that you're looking almost purely right at the economics, and you're saying, look, it's almost cheaper just to burn, you know, the bunker fuel. You invested in scrubbers. So you have a balanced approach there. Let's just do that and build up cash and see what happens, right? This is a decision we can make in the future. We're running out of time, basically over. Ted, I'll give you and John my sort of Christmas wish list a little bit early, 2 months early. Look, last time we talked, you know, we talked last year about repurchases, and I gave you a target, a bar, and you cleared it, and it was awesome. You know, I really want to see that $50 million used up at this point. I mean, we're at 40% price to NAV. It is an amazing investment. You're investing in your own fleet. And I'd like to see, a re-up. I think you did a re-up, what was it, last January, last December, where you said, yep. Hey, we're re-upping from 50 to 100. You know, if you re-up from 100 to 150, give or take around Christmas, that would be, I think, a fantastic Christmas gift and signal to all of us investors. So I know you can't comment on that, but it just letting you know where I'm setting the bar.
We're making our list and checking it twice, Jay.
All right. Fantastic. Thank you, Ted. Thank you, John, for joining us today.
You're welcome.
Thanks, Jay. Thanks for all the investors, everyone on the call. We really appreciate it.
Yeah. Thank you very much.
This was an iteration of Value Investor's Edge Live, recorded in the morning of 5 November 2020. As a reminder, nothing you heard today constitutes official company guidance or investment recommendations of any format. I currently have a long position in Dorian stock and options. Please keep in mind this disclosure is as of 5 November 2020 and may change in the future going forward.
If you've been enjoying the Seeking Alpha Marketplace Roundtable podcast, you can subscribe through iTunes, Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, or Stitcher. You can also give reviews on those platforms to help other investors discover this podcast. Jay Mintzmyer runs the Value Investor's Edge Marketplace service here at Seeking Alpha. You can subscribe to Value Investor's Edge by going to seekingalpha.com and typing Jay Mintzmyer, that's Mintzmyer, or Value Investor's Edge into the search bar at the top of the site, or by going to seekingalpha.com/marketplace and looking for Value Investor's Edge there.